shooting activists, to create supportive communities for survivors, and not just because the posts that those survivors need to see are going to get lost in the din, but also because the platform becomes a hostile environment where survivors aren't going to want to be spending their time. A Pew Research study from back in 2020 found that 41% of Americans have personally experienced some form of online harassment. And there's every reason to believe that that has only gotten worse in the past few years. And that's with moderation being legal. So it's just not the same as providing telecommunication services or other utility access. This is another issue, but I would argue that it makes sense to designate ISPs as common carriers. But there just isn't a match with social media platforms, either in terms of the rationale for why we would call them a common carrier or for the social costs of banning moderation.
I agree with that. Zach, another issue the justices considered is application of Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. In a nutshell, Section 230 generally provides immunity for online computer services with respect to third-party content generated by its users. It promotes free speech by removing strong incentives for platforms to limit what we can say and do online. But notably, before Section 230 was enacted, companies cultivating online communities were legally responsible for what their users posted.
And this is where social media corporations and progressive activists are going to part ways, and actually where the companies find themselves in a little bit of a bind. The platforms, the social media corporations, are pushing materials to users in ways that, at least I would argue, should be more carefully regulated and for which they should be held liable when their product design causes harm. But of course, the companies want to claim free speech rights without acknowledging that they're engaged in the kind of speech that might actually fall outside of 230 immunity.
Let's take a listen to a very short exchange on Section 230. This is between Paul Clement and members of the court.
It's speech for purposes of the First Amendment, your speech, your editorial control. But when we get to Section 230, your submission is that that isn't your speech.
Yes, as a matter of statutory construction, because otherwise Section 230 ends up being self-defeating. Because, again, the whole point of Section 230 was to promote that editorial discretion. And this Court, you know, this Court wrestled with these issues. They're hard issues. And I certainly applaud the instinct that you shouldn't resolve them here. But I don't think just by recognizing that my clients are engaged in editorial discretion when they make those decisions about what's going to ultimately go to the individualized screen that a user's going to see when they tap into their website or their application. I don't think that's the kind of speech that is you're talking about in the 230 context. And if you did, I think you would defeat the fundamental purpose of 230, because they wanted you. They wanted my clients and others to exercise that editorial discretion to keep the bad material
out. With respect to other people's speech. So it seems like we have speech, and then we have speech.
You can't – you literally – and this is – again, I'm happy to argue that case right now if we want to, but you can't have –
Well, no, it's a really hard question for us, and it's perfectly relevant here and very important because, of course, 230 preempts things, and we don't know how much of this law it preempts.
Absolutely. But this law is unconstitutional in all its applications, and certainly in its, it has no plainly legitimate sweep. So you don't have to reach the 230 question directly here. And I would simply say that when you're reading those statutory terms in 230, you wouldn't sweep in editorial discretion, because if you do, you will defeat the fundamental purpose of Section 230, which is to empower editorial discretion.
Well, I just wanted to raise with you the question I raised with the Solicitor General, who offered a thoughtful response. But many of your clients' terms of service, while reserving some editorial discretion, and I think about most of them as speaking about the things covered by 230, obscenity, et cetera, go out of their way to promise an open forum to all members of the public and go out of their way to say we don't endorse what other people say on this site and go out of their way to say all views shall flourish. Now, that's not true for all of your clients, but it's true for some of them, and many of them. What do we do about that?
That was part of an exchange between appellate attorney Paul Clement and several justices from last month's oral arguments in the case Moody v. NetChoice and NetChoice v. Paxton. Zach, in terms of Section 230 liability, we have to mention cases against three tech giants. You'll recall that U.S. citizen Noemi Gonzalez was killed by a terrorist attack in France back in 2015. The next day, ISIS claimed responsibility and released a YouTube video. Gonzalez's father sued Google, Twitter, and Facebook, claiming, among other things, that all three platforms were liable for aiding and abetting international terrorism. He said they failed to take meaningful action to prevent terrorists from using its services. Then in 2023, in Twitter v. Tamne, the Supreme Court unanimously declined to impose secondary liability on tech companies for allegedly failing to prevent ISIS from using their platforms for recruiting, fundraising, and organizing. How do those cases relate to this?
So really importantly, those rulings that you just mentioned, the lawsuits against Twitter and Google as parent company for YouTube, held that the Anti-Terrorism Act, which is the law under which those plaintiffs were suing, does not reach the sort of conduct that that suit alleged. Essentially, the ruling was that providing a platform used by terrorists doesn't constitute aiding and abetting or providing material support. So the court didn't reach the Section 230 immunity issue. It was a big win for social media corporations, but it did not insulate them from all lawsuits alleging harm by the design of their products or the functioning of their algorithms, as long as the claims being brought against them are for violation of laws other than the Anti-Terrorism Act. And there are just such lawsuits going forward right now against social media companies. For example, two major cases brought by states and by parents alleging that social media is designed to maximize screen time in a way that's especially harmful to young people, and that it aggravates body image issues and bullying and other sorts of social problems. So as a larger point, I would say that those sorts of lawsuits are an example of why the Florida and Texas laws are not what we need. The law has ways to require social media companies to do better at protecting against the harm that their platforms can cause. As I said at the start, the Florida and Texas laws are just not aimed at the real damages and harm from social media. But existing product liability and negligence laws and other kinds of doctrines can be directed at social media companies in ways that would not cause the sorts of problems that we've been discussing of requiring them to remote posts from school shooting deniers the same way they do survivor networks. If anyone wants to follow those sorts of lawsuits, the lawsuits by the parents have been consolidated as In Re Social Media Adolescent Addiction / Personal Injury Product Liability Litigation, it's a long one, and it advances claims based on consumer protection laws, negligence, and fraudulent concealment. And then there's an action by 33 states captioned Arizona versus Meta that brings claims for false advertising and violations of various business regulations and consumer protection laws.
Zach, we're running out of our allotted time. A quick question. If you were on the Supreme Court, how would you rule in these two cases?
Highly hypothetical scenario. But you know, one of the most fundamental premises of free speech is that we keep the government out of the role of censor, and we let the marketplace of ideas work out the best approaches to social issues. There's obviously limits on that, like with negligence and product liability, like I was just discussing. There's also fraud and harassment and any number of other concepts that can be brought to bear. But how do we create this sort of modern salon of online communities without allowing them to be disrupted by bigots and conspiracy theorists is a problem that the people need to be allowed to figure out. And there are strong efforts underway trying to figure out how to do that. The Santa Clara Principle started out as from human rights activists, set of ideas from human rights activists and academics about how do we deal with hate speech online, and it's now been endorsed by some of the major players in the space. The issue continues to get attention from activists and scholars, including even the National Academy of Sciences recently. We obviously need more of this, demanding corporate responsibility from the social media companies, and I'm sure we'll get it. But on this law, on these cases, I would just strike down the Florida and Texas laws and let that litigation, social activism, and experimentation unfold and find the better way forward.
Mm. I love that, Zach. And when I'm president, I'm going to nominate you to the High Court. Zach Wolf, Your insights are always appreciated. We look forward to having you back when the High Court comes forth with its ruling so that we can analyze what they decide. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi. This was wonderful.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
International human aid organizations have been documenting and warning that Israel was committing crimes of war after bombing Gaza after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attacks. Yet major media outlets and social media platforms have consistently ignored these on-the-ground reports. As Israel's attacks escalated into acts of genocide, corporate media coverage has largely framed such violence as defensive and justified. Glaringly absent has been reporting on Israel's long-established use of violence and deprivation against Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and occupied East Jerusalem. As we've been covering on Law and Disorder, 50 years after Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, it has systematically repressed and abused the rights of the Palestinian population. It's long recognized by most state and international bodies that Israeli settlements themselves are illegal under international law. And Gaza's government media office has reported that at least 126 Palestinian journalists have been killed since Israel's war began on October 7th. What factors have contributed to Israel avoiding moral and legal culpability for its acts of genocide? As it turns out, there are many, from Israel employing propaganda, falsifying evidence, to the censorship and silencing of U.S. journalists and commentators, as well as repression of dissident voices online and off. And powerful Israeli lobbying forces have effectively silenced any criticism of Israel. To explore these issues, our guest today is award-winning author Robin Anderson. Robin is Professor Emerita of Media Studies at Fordham University. She writes media criticism for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and many other outlets, and works with Project Censored as a contributor to its annual State of the Free Press book. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, won the Alpha Sigma Nu Book Award in 2007. Robin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me, Heidi.
Now, Robin, since we're going to be talking about media, let's start with some terminology. What is legacy media?
Legacy media is things that have been around for a long time. So it's the New York Times. It's the Washington Post. So the papers of record, network television. Sometimes I think CNN has been around for a very long time, and it has, but you know it came online as a cable network. So it's just another way of talking about old big media.
Robin, please describe how legacy media has been describing victims of Israel's war crimes, including the photographic coverage.
Right. Well, what comes to mind right away, Michael, is that victims are not seen as real people, just like Hamas was demonized at the beginning of the genocide. There's various ways that they're even demonizing Palestinians as they're being bombed and starved. So, for example, in the latest flower massacre, the Palestinians were said to be trampling on one another and stampeding like a mob. And the Economist went so far as to say that anarchy is ruling in Gaza, and saying that the convoy was set upon by these starving people, and as if the convoy was the one that was murdered, or the convoy was murdered and not the people of Palestine. So, you know, Israeli victims after October 7th were slaughtered and massacred, and Palestinian are further dehumanized by simply using the abstract language of numbers and not really being humanized.
It sounds like a massive public relations undertaking. Robin, what are the primary forces that serve to keep the public from learning about Israel's genocidal actions toward Palestinians in Gaza?
Right, Heidi. AIPAC and other Israeli lobby groups have been very good over the last decade, really. They've been around much longer than that, but really accelerated their activities by creating a public sphere where it hasn't been safe to criticize the state of Israel. We've seen the term anti-Semitism brought against many Jews, and certainly many non-Jews, who have called for a ceasefire, who have identified genocide. Any way that we've criticized this, it has been attacked. And as I say, this comes from a long line of doing this. Most recently, if we look at the Academy Awards, where you've got the zone of interest, and you've got Glazer up there who's just received the prize as the Academy Award, and he says, you know, we refute our Jewishness and the occupation, and we're tired of it being carried out in our names. So that was immediately stopped after we refute our Jewishness by the Newsweek editor, opinion editor. This amazing person who just did a film about the Holocaust and has said demonization, it's not only about then, it's about what's happening now. And refusing to allow his Jewishness to be used to justify the occupation and the genocide, he's actually called anti-Semitic. So, you know, in 2016, as Rashid Halidi reported in his book, The 100-Year War on Palestine, public opinion in the United States started to go toward Palestine. Polls showed that there was a shift, and people had become more critical of the state of Israel and seeing that conflict more through the eyes of the Palestinians. And AIPAC and Canary Mission and Honest Reporting, all these lobby groups have had big effects on our institutions, universities, student activities, and in journalism as well.
Robin, talk more, if you will, please, about the Israeli lobbying machine. It seems to be targeting students, organizations, individuals, and the media. Tell us about the lobbying machine, please.
Right. Well, there's a group called Honest Reporting, and they've been instrumental in getting some journalists fired. There was this wonderful Palestinian photojournalist who worked for the New York Times for 4 years. They dug up, Honest Reporting said, he made this Facebook post that was pro-Palestinian. So the New York Times fired him. We saw that the president of Harvard was targeted and she was fired. We've seen this over and over again. Lamont Hill on CNN a year and a half ago was fired from his commentary position because he attended a Palestinian day at the United Nations. And that was CNN. We know, of course, that Mehdi Hassan was taken off of the air. He was taken off of his show, and then he retired from MSNBC because he wasn't going to be demoted like that. But there's many different organizations, but we know that the great book by Ryan Grimm, now writes for The Intercept, published AOC and the Promise of the Squad, and documented the way AIPAC has primaried, the word that we use for, challenged any politician who has been critical of the state of Israel, challenging them in the primaries and giving millions of dollars to any candidate who will oppose them, who toes the line on the state of Israel. So all of these forces have been in play, and we see them now in a real effort to create consensus, to manufacture consensus against, if you will, any critical voices being able to be heard in our public and media discourse.
Robin, we hear so much now about so-called fake news, doctored images, artificial intelligence. Are you aware of any instances where pro-Israel media may have altered images or presented what we call fake news, disinformation?
The easiest thing to do mostly online is to misidentify footage. And we don't really know, you know, the motivation behind it. Sometimes an incident that was reported online, some Israelis beat up Palestinians, it could be a time when it was not at the present, and it was labeled as something that was happening now on the West Bank or something. We don't know who posts those. Those could be posted to discredit Palestinians. On either side, though, that can happen, and that's the most common way. I don't think at this point, and certainly not now, it is fairly easy to detect when a photograph has been altered, that we saw in Kate Middleton, the princess, when she'd been out of the public view for a while. That image was clearly, it was silly for them to post it, it was clearly altered. For example, the Israelis, when they've committed a war crime against Al-Shifa Hospital, for example, they put up audio tape that was supposed to be a conversation between a jihadist and a Hamas fighter. They were saying that they targeted the hospital. The tape wasn't in the right dialect of Arabic. It was clearly altered. They didn't speak in the proper accents. Those kinds of things have been identified. How the Israelis have been using it, also in the latest flower massacre, is they put up aerial footage. And then people easily saw that it was in four segments. And the moment at which the IDF shoots and lobs missiles at the starving Palestinians trying to collect aid from the convoy, they've taken that out. So the way the Israelis have been using that is not that they don't understand that they're going to be found out. It's that they're always buying for time. Each time they buy for time, the video gets discussed ad infinitum in the media. It takes up all the space, all the news cycle on the particular event, and then they move over to another event. So the Israeli flower massacre has now been allowed to simply pass us by, completely being lost in this befuddling dialogue of back and forth. Really, the Hamas never gets to say anything. It's what the Israeli health ministry documents always posted against and put in contrast to official Israeli statements. So I think that right now, in this moment in time, that's the way fake videos and altered things we need to really point out have been very instrumental in prolonging and buying time for the genocide and allowing them to get away with basically war crime after war crime.
How does the U.S. military-industrial complex inform this virtual blackout in coverage of Israelis' war crimes?
Well, I was just on a panel with Project Censored and the Media Education Foundation, and we were talking about a film that documents the long history of the Pentagon's role in Hollywood and shaping Hollywood films, and not just Hollywood films, but all aspects of programming by, filmmakers make huge profits. If they allow their scripts to be put through the censors at the Pentagon, then they reap the benefits of all of the massive weaponry. And this, of course, is at the taxpayers' expense. So if you want access to these powerful movies directed by Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer, for example, Pearl Harbor and Black Hawk Down and those kinds of films, they have gone through a censor. What the censors of the military and the Pentagon at the Office of Liaisons, what they take out are any kind of things that challenges military hierarchy. The themes that are routinely censored are war crimes, any mention of illegal activity on the part of the U.S. military. And so we've got this. Oh, this has been going on for over 30 years now, and just so if people are interested in seeing this incredible documentation full of clips from mainstream films and then on to cooking shows and things like that, the name of the film is Theaters of War, and it is produced by the Media Education Foundation. The way I see it as getting us ready for to accept a genocide is that over the years they've created a very pro-military, kind of militarized culture that dominates the silver screen, the small screen, video games. When we know that there are propaganda messages, for example, those propaganda messages are better accepted if there's kind of a background, foundational way of thinking that goes along with the atrocities. So when people are hearing on October 7th, for example, that Hamas engaged in mass rape, that they just killed all of these civilians, they're terrorists, they're dehumanized, that it expands into Palestine and Gaza. And when you get these Israeli officials saying, you know, we're going to have this huge response, there's going to be no food, no electricity, there's going to be nothing. They wanted hell, we'll give them hell, we'll turn it into a tent city. That kind of demonization that a group and a people have been identified as subhuman and non-human, that allows that kind of military response. If we think of blockbuster movies influenced by the Pentagon, these are not complex, nuanced narratives. These are narratives that divide the world between an easily identified, dehumanized enemy and the wonderful effects of U.S. intervention, how it's benevolent, and how it goes in to save people or take out an enemy or things like that. So that's how I believe our utter lack of criticism of the Pentagon also in any kind of budgetary. We never hold them accountable in the press. It's become this very bipartisan push for more and more military aid. And we've known now that Biden has sent 100 shipments of military aid to Israel, but knowing that that's so unpopular, it's been done in secret. So these are the way I think these things interact in public discourse and are played out in real horrifying ways now, as we see in the Gaza genocide.
And Robin, it certainly doesn't help that we see a proliferation of junior ROTC programs in public schools around the nation to really reinforce that kind of Pentagon aspect that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the mandate of Hollywood films such as Act of Valor, which started out as an advertisement for the Army, the mandate for that. But of course, what we know also is that commercial funding for R&D development for so many of our video games that children really mm-hmm. love are openly designed as also part of recruitment and have been for many years. I've written a lot about Call of Duty and things like that, and I interviewed a couple of ROTC students when I was at Fordham, and they talked about using video games in training and how the recruiters come to the new launches of each new video game and affect recruiting. So those things feed into this culture where it basically becomes acceptable if you don't have a lot of money to go to school, you accept ROTC, and if you need an income, you join the Army. That's what also we've been seeing over the years.
Now, Robin, all of this makes it sound as though American media outlets and entertainment have become genocide apologists. Does pro-Israel U.S. media coverage make our nation complicit in genocide, in your opinion?
Oh, I absolutely believe that's true. And there are a couple of suits, one by CCR, as we know, that has made that argument in the Biden administration. I believe that the way the media parroted the pro-Israeli statements, always have taken everything they said and run with them. That is to say, repeated any justification for a war crime from bombing a hospital, from bombing refugees in transit, from bombing people seeking aid. These are all crimes against humanity. And every single time the Israelis get caught doing it, U.S. media has condoned and repeated their explanations and questioned anything coming out of the Gaza Health Ministry and belittling and denying those facts. And also the complete erasure within the public sphere of international aid organizations, humanitarian aid. Save the Children, for example, says what we're seeing now in Gaza is the worst-case scenario being played out. UNICEF has said the same thing. The people who Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has said this is a war crime. They're denying people food. So there's currently an engineered famine in Gaza. And the U.S. media is complicit in not reporting that on the ground, where you had Al Jazeera reporters, you had Euromed staff, you have testimonials, you have footage from on the ground, instead of acting as real journalists and taking and finding the footage and telling what happened when, they're simply repeating Israeli denials that justify these murders. And I believe at some point over the course of this, it's going to be discovered that journalists and media outlets have to have been well aware that these things were happening. Certainly from a moral and ethical point of view, for the mandate of journalism, they are complicit in genocide. I believe from the mandate of journalism, what we've identified so many times is not journalism. It's dressed up rhetoric or fictionist prose. It's not the conveying of information to active citizens so they can participate in a democratic process. That's the mandate of journalism. They have not been fulfilling that. In terms of the op-ed pages of the New York Times, all we need to do is look at Thomas Friedman's metaphors that are historically openly genocidal, where he likens the Palestinian people to wasps and Hamas to wasps and insects that eat out individuals. And Fair did a fantastic job of pointing that out, complete with an image from Nazi Germany that shows a spider eating people. Of course, the spider represents Jews. And as the director that got the award for Zone of Interest said, that kind of demonization is not in the past. He didn't make the film to talk about it was in the past. He talked about it as now. And we know that the first step of genocide is demonization.
This is Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. And we're speaking with Robin Anderson, whose critique of the media has been profound. Robin, talk about social media's role in advancing a pro-Israel narrative, please.
Well, there are what people call pro-Israeli apologists online. Caitlin Johnson, the commentator that I like the best. They will create cover for any aspect of what's going on in Gaza. What I think the most damning things that the IDF itself has been posting are its own soldiers who are mocking the Palestinians as they blow them up. As they kill them, they cheer. You see things online that are happening in Israel that you don't see in the mainstream press. you see so many atrocities on the field, and you see most notably and interestingly, so many of these IDF soldiers have gone through Palestinian homes and pulled out women's underwear, and they can be seen wearing their lingerie or brassieres over their uniforms and dancing around in them. These things are being very well documented. We're trying to get a handle on the social dynamics of that and the social psychology of it. But it seems that they feel no boundaries between what they can do to Palestinians and how they can even put those images over online.
Robin, I hate to say it, but we're running out of our allotted time. We could listen to you for a full hour. How can our listeners follow your work?
Oh, I can be found on various platforms such as Project Censored, Fair, Counterpunch. The first piece I wrote about Palestine and Israel's attack on the Palestinians kind of went across a variety of platforms. But I guess the best place to find me is on Fair.
Terrific. Robin, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Been great talking to you both. Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
You're listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
a time in my life. This story goes to tell you of a time in my life when nobody else cared for me. Everything was against me, no money, no wife, but just an old and heartbroken guitar. Oh yes, no one to assist me, no friends did come my way, neither brother in my favor did ever come true. One day I was tempted to put on some rags and go out like a pauper to start begging my bread, and also to commit suicide, my eyes are so red. Oh Lord, it is hunger, do have pity on me. Oh yes, no one to caress me, no one to whisper I love you. Odds were all against me, no one to say cheer up to me and my guitar. When it did rain down sorrow, it rained down on me, no one yet so hard off. I started concentrating on becoming a thief. Oh, but the sense of my birthright was my only fright. Oh no, why must I steal? Though drastic my predicament, this would bring me so the one thing I did, I knelt down in prayer quite sincere, that the Lord may be with me till my dreams all come true.
Love to you, you don't move the way you used to. You keep telling me to give it a little more. Thank you.